Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the phenomenon of sexting and an analysis of the role of women in the Anthony Weiner affair, who have been portrayed as victims when it is clear they are active participants in what our first guest, Susan Jacoby, calls a coarse and creepy internet culture dedicated to male and female desires for virtual carnal knowledge. She is the author of The Last Men on Top and has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Weiner's Women. Then we'll examine today's declassification of secret NSA surveillance programs following the leaks by Edward Snowden. Former counsel to Senator Russ Feingold, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss the incremental assault on our civil liberties since 9/11 and her article at the Christian Science Monitor, The Danger of American Apathy on NSA Surveillance. Then finally, we will discuss President Obama's grand bargain to revive the economy and the report just out from the Dallas Fed, How Bad Was It? The Costs and Consequences of the 2008 Financial Crisis, which conservatively estimates the damage at $14 trillion, the equivalent of 1 year's U.S. GDP. The author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, Jeff Madrick, joins us. He contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and writes a column on economics for Harper's. And joining us now is Susan Jacoby, who's an author of 10 books, including Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, and The Age of American Unreason. Her most recent e-book is The Last Men on Top, and she has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Weiner's Women, which examines Anthony Weiner's sexting scandal and the women who participate in that coarse and creepy internet culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Jacoby.
Hi, good to be here with you.
And Susan, tell me it's not true that in the 21st century we are so bereft of human interaction that we have to invent avatars in order to have virtual sex?
Well, not everyone. First of all, I should say this really, although that was the headline, this really wasn't an essay about Anthony Weiner's women. It's about the whole phenomenon with which Anthony Weiner represents. This is, of course, a big political story in New York. But apart from the fact that Anthony Weiner is who he is, he's running for mayor of New York, there are huge numbers of men and huge numbers of women. We don't know whether it's hundreds of thousands or millions who participate in these activities every day, which is virtual sex on the internet. And I think one of the reasons this has been the narrative of this, it's a great narrative for the media, the national media, is that this is a powerful man abusing his power who doesn't respect women. Well, I'm sure he doesn't respect women, but that's not the point about this whole thing. There are women who participate in this, too. This is not something that men do to women. The internet is something which, if I got a picture of Anthony Weiner's penis on my computer, I would delete it and block any further things. The fact is that there are huge numbers of people in this country, men and women, who are so lonely and just have such a low opinion of themselves that this is what they do. You know, I said in the piece, I said, virtual sex is to sex as virtual food is to food. You can't taste it, you can't touch it, you can't smell it, and it requires no work. And there is a significant part of our culture, we don't know how large, but it is a significant number of people who do this all the time. And I think that's a whole larger social story, bigger than Anthony Weiner, that's just been ignored by the media.
So when you say in your article, Susan Jacoby, that 20th century feminism always linked the social progress of women with an expanding sense of self-worth, what are you saying about contemporary women, particularly young women who, of course, are, you know, you often see young people sitting at restaurants, all four of them are sitting at a table staring at their palms on their iPhones?
Well, I don't think they're sexting. I think that they're taking pictures of their food, which is which is another trend. You send pictures of your food in restaurants to people. But I don't think that this is it's just a matter of younger people doing this and older people not. I suspect we would be surprised at how many outwardly respectable married people, men and women, who are not politicians, so nobody is going to tell on them, are doing this kind of thing. And I think there are many ways for women in which it's a lot safer if you want to have sex play on the internet. Well, it's a lot safer than picking up strangers in bars and going home with them. But there is nothing good about this, and it was never anything. The idea, I have no nostalgia for the double standard of the 1950s when I grew up, in which women were supposed to be the gatekeepers of sexual propriety. But this is just a sad and empty thing for both women and men. I think it's an example, again, of something that's a larger phenomenon even than sex. But in some ways, the internet, which is supposed to bring people together, brings them farther apart. I think that this kind of virtual sex is exactly like what we all know. And again, it's not just young people. I think it's what we all know, the substituting of texting and emailing and Twitter for face-to-face time with friends, in which these brief sort of off-the-cuff exchanges substitute for real friendship. Well, I think virtual sex is the same way. It substitutes for real sex, which requires a lot more energy and time and involvement. And that's sad. And I think the media has missed the big story here because they're so fixated on it being one politician who does it.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Jacoby, the author of 10 books, including Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, and The Age of American Unreason. Her most recent e-book is The Last Men on Top, and she has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Weiner's Women, which examines Anthony Weiner's sexting scandal and the women who participate in that coarse and creepy internet culture. So, but is this just an extension of how young people, for example, are into gaming? Many young kids spend most of their waking hours, apart from school, creating and involving themselves and living in this virtual world with virtual money and characters, etc. And they don't have the human contact that you're talking about. They're not with their friends. They're alone in their rooms with their computers. And so I suppose in a way it's not surprising that when these kids grow up, they would graduate to virtual sex.
You know, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I've written about this a lot. I don't think the substitution of virtual reality for reality, I think those kids would be doing a lot better being out playing baseball outdoors than sitting looking at video games. But I don't want to sound like, and I don't believe it, that computers are a demonic thing. They are one element in a kind of loneliness and alienation and a sort of breakdown of all kinds of social institutions. You know, dating and courtship were one of those social institutions. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying I have any nostalgia for the kind of double standard of sexual morality I was brought up with, but it is really upsetting to see this replaced by a double standard. Almost all of the media reports on Weiner have just presented this as an abuse of power by a rogue male, as if women were not equal participants in this kind of thing. It's not like the mayor of San Diego sexually harassing women in his office, women who needed to do business with him. All you have to do when somebody makes an approach to you on the internet is cut them off and block them. There are women who like to do this. And I think, you know, I think that upsets, particularly, it's not, both women and men have just sort of ignored this aspect of it, that it takes two to tangle. Now, of course, we don't know that all of the people that Anthony Weiner or anybody else on the Internet is sexting with and exchanging pictures with really is a woman. I'm waiting for the first gay man to come forward and say, hey, Anthony Weiner didn't know it, but he was sexting with me. Because this is the sort of poverty of virtual sex. Is the truth is, you don't really know who it is. It has nothing to do with an individual. It is like that classic New Yorker cartoon saying, you know, on the Internet, no one knows you're a dog. You don't know who you're talking to. It's just a kind of instant gratification with nothing involved, including any actual knowledge. These people could be anybody. They could be 12-year-old boys or 84-year-old men.
Right. Well, but I guess, you know, you're there in New York and this extraordinary character who seems to be tone deaf to reality, Anthony Weiner, is still running for mayor of New York. I'm out here in Hollywood, and I tell you, if you wrote a screenplay where the people, the characters were having virtual sex, and one was called Carlos Danger and the other Sidney Leathers, they would think that was over the top. But
well, Sidney Leathers is apparently a real name. But
exactly.
But I really object. I also think in a way, it shows that in some ways we're still programmed, in spite of feminism, to think man bad, woman good, man aggressor, woman victim. That is absolutely not true of virtual sex.
Right.
So I think we need to be thinking about, you know, what kind of a society we are in general and how we've substituted the easy, effortless ways of the Internet in the most intimate areas of human relations.
Sure.
For real things, whether it's friendship or love or sex or education or anything else. There is a very serious issue here beyond politics, beyond Anthony Weiner, which, as usual, the mainstream media has missed. Because, of
right.
course,
well,
it's a great, funny story.
Right. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Susan Jacoby. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Susan Jacoby, the author of 10 books, including Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism, and The Age of American Unreason. Her most recent e-book is Last Men on Top, and she has an article in Wednesday's New York Times, Weiner's Women. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the danger of American apathy on NSA surveillance.
At last, my heart's an open door, and my secret love's no secret anymore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at the Christian Science Monitor is The Danger of American Apathy in NSA Surveillance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thanks very much.
And there's been quite a lot of activity on the Hill today with declassifying the Director of National Intelligence, declassified documents. Much of what is sort of being declassified appears to be trying to catch up to what's been leaked by Edward Snowden. But you've written about this in, I think, a much more interesting and compelling context, and that is the extent to which we're witnessing around the world, and particularly in the Arab world, people dying for freedom. And you're arguing that little by little, Americans are allowing their government to chip away at the fortress of legal protections that people in less privileged societies, including multiple nations in the Arab world, are giving their lives to build. What's your sense of whether the American people are going to wake up to this cumulative effect of their rights being chipped away at?
Well, one of the points that I made in the op-ed is that I think half of Americans really have woken up and have realized that this is happening and are starting to push back. And I think that's why we're starting to see some legislative initiatives to curb surveillance powers. But there's half of the public that is quite willing to give up liberties in return for what they believe to be greater security. And I guess part of what I'm asking is that people set the bar a little bit higher for what the government has to show in terms of the security that's being provided and how effective that these programs are before being willing to give away these freedoms because it is significant. It's not just a little incursion on our privacy. It's part of a pattern. And I think if people could take a step back and see the pattern, they might demand a little more evidence from the government before they gave up yet more liberty.
So I guess this very close vote in the House last week is a bellwether for the division in America?
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a bellwether for what's going to happen going forward. I think there will be a battle. I think the battle will play out in Congress as well as in the public sphere. And I think it's a fairly evenly pitched battle at this point. But I think that, you know, it's still early in terms of the American people actually having had time to understand and digest what's been going on. And I think that as revelations continue, and they are continuing, the picture will become clearer and people's viewpoints will crystallize. So I'm not trying to say that I think we're frozen in a position where half the country feels one way and half the country feels the other way. I don't think that's true. I think this is very much in flux.
But surely it's not an even or level playing field in the sense that it is civil libertarians and outraged citizens versus the political establishment, the intelligence establishment, the defense establishment. I mean, the patronizing attitude of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid that you mention in your article, Elizabeth Goitein, when confronted by the domestic spying of the NSA, his advice was, quoting, just calm down and understand that this isn't anything that is brand new. Well, a lot of people in the press had that attitude about Snowden. Oh, we've heard all this before, and therefore it's not important. I mean, extraordinary to me that that attitude is a way to deflect the importance of what is going on.
It's interesting because I think I actually used the word patronizing in my first draft and then at some point took it out. But that's exactly right. I mean, when I read that quote, when I heard that he had said this, my response was, wait a minute, it's not brand new? That's worse. I mean, if it's been going on for 7 years, that makes it worse, not better. So you're right. There's not a level playing field. There's certainly an informational advantage that the government has. It knows a lot more, not only about its programs, but about any purported benefit that the programs have, because the government is in a position to make assertions about the benefit of these programs and then say, well, we can't really provide the details because they're classified. So that, you know, makes the playing field less level. That said, people in Congress want to hold office. They want to be reelected. If their constituents are upset and they are hearing from their constituents in a concerted way, and people feel passionately enough about this, they will take notice and they will take action.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. She has an article at the Christian Science Monitor, The Danger of American Apathy in NSA Surveillance. So what's the sense then of possible changes on the judicial branch? We've seen now on the legislative branch, we had the vote that came in very close. And I guess at this point, I'm not sure. I know there are a couple of senators on the Intelligence Committee who, for the longest time, have been hinting that things are there's far more going on than we know about. And I'm talking about Jeff Merkley and Udall. But on the judicial side, it was revealed recently that the Chief Justice John Roberts has basically appointed all of these extremely conservative judges on the FISA court. Is there any way to have a more representative FISA court that's less inclined towards national security and more inclined towards civil liberties?
I think there are proposals out there for changing the way the appointments process works. I don't know how much traction they'll get. I will say that I was very surprised to learn when I first learned that 10 out of the 11 judges had been appointed by either Bush, Reagan, or Bush. But then I was also surprised to learn, sort of following up on that, that the record of granting or denying surveillance requests actually had not shifted over time with the changing composition of the court, so that even when the court was much more evenly representative, its record was about the same.
Meaning that the preponderance of the government's bias is towards surveillance as opposed to civil liberties, isn't it? It's pretty heavily slanted in that direction, isn't it?
Well, what I was saying there was just that the record of the court in terms of granting the government's requests for surveillance has been fairly consistent over time.
But isn't it about 90% or something, or 99%?
It's more than 99%.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah. It's enormous. I realize that I shouldn't be that surprised by the consistency, because national security is one of those areas where judges of all different ideologies that vote very differently or rule very differently on other issues tend to come together and support claims of national security, or I should say tend to defer to government claims of national security fairly uniformly. So the judges being inclined to defer to government claims of national security interests, to me, that is not a sign that we need more ideological diversity on the court. It's a sign that we need somebody else there arguing the other side in order to try to push back against the natural inclination to defer.
But the overall point that you're trying to make, Elizabeth Guillotine, particularly in your article, The Christian Science Monitor, The Danger of American Apathy on NSA Surveillance, is the extent to which there has been a steady erosion and diminution of legal protection since 9/11, and that the choices really haven't been made, they haven't been debated, and that I guess the correlation of forces are that, you know, the government powers must be a matter of choice, not passive acquiescence to secret expansion. Now, that seems to have been what's happened in response to 9/11. Do you detect a sea change now? I mean, how can we correlate the restrictions on the Fourth Amendment, et cetera, and the massive amount of government data that's being gathered, and just this leak today that's in The Guardian, to one program, which is apparently a training slides of a program that Snowden released, indicates that they can process something like 40 billion pieces of data. So that's happening on the one hand. And then on the other hand, we end up with a couple of, as they were described by their uncle, losers in Boston, with about $100 worth of material, shutting down an entire American city for a week. It turns out that they weren't a part of any great international network. And that's basically might well be the profile of the threats we're facing. So where does the proportionality come into this?
Mm-hmm.
We're
spending
$1 trillion on Homeland Security, and a couple of bozos for $100 can shut down an American city. In many ways, it starts to feel to me like this is what we do to ourselves, not what they do to us.
Right, right. Well, I think there are probably people out there who really are willing to give everything away in order to have 100% security from the possibility of a terrorist attack. But first of all, I think most people probably don't feel that way. I think most people understand that it's a balance and that there are other things that are important to them in terms of the exercise of their liberties. But then the other thing I would say is that you can't ever be 100% safe from a terrorist attack. I mean, that's just a fact. And there is no evidence that dragnet surveillance of Americans' data and information is the way to get closer to that point. I mean, if anything, there's some evidence in the other direction that really government agencies have been drowning in data and they haven't been able to make appropriate use of it because there's too much of it. So it's not a good trade-off.
Sure, but Elizabeth, if the reality is that we are a million times more vulnerable to slipping in the shower and hurting ourselves than we are to a terrorist attack, and I believe the statistics are pretty extraordinary on this. I mean, the chances of a terrorist attack are about equal to being visited by a UFO. So that's what I'm asking about, proportionality. The president's asked for a debate here. Isn't that a good place to start, about a cost-benefit analysis of what we're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I think a cost-benefit analysis absolutely needs to be done, and I think that cost-benefit analysis is particularly critical because there really are some indications that not only that we're getting very small benefit in return for high cost, but that some of our policies may actually be counterproductive, and that if you really want to catch terrorists, then you need to focus in on the people whose behavior actually gives rise to some sort of suspicion of criminal activity, and that dragnet surveillance is just wasting resources and not moving you closer to the goal. So yes, a cost-benefit analysis is most definitely in order.
And do you think that we'll learn more, Elizabeth Goitein? I mean, the leak that from The Guardian today on this program called X-Keyscore, which apparently is a training program. Snowden apparently released a bunch of slides. And the one that I was mentioning earlier said that nearly 42 billion records had been captured by the system during a one-month period in 2012. So it seems that we have created this extraordinary secret, what can we call it, the machine, and I've made this point to other people in the national security field, asked them the simple question. During the Cold War, I worked on arms control with the Soviet Union, and one of the rackets of deterrence in those days was that there was never enough deterrence. So both sides were free to keep building planes, submarines, spending trillions of dollars on an endless pursuit of security, and that the more you built, the less secure you became. That was the paradox. Are we in a similar situation where in the information age, there's never enough information? So there's nothing to restrain the NSA and the taxpayer who funds it.
I think that's right. I think that is the situation we're in, and I think there is just an unquenchable thirst for more information in the national security community. And there are other parallels to the Cold War as well. You know, there were corporations that were making, you know, just incredible amounts of money off of the weapons system that we had back then. And there are private interests making a tremendous amount of money off the surveillance state. And so there are some very powerful, very wealthy interests that are going to be arrayed against reform, against right-sizing the national security establishment, and against curtailing some of these surveillance authorities.
So what do you think will be – we don't know what the fate of Edward Snowden will be, but he said that he wanted to start a debate, but then he ended up in the hands of the Chinese and the Russians, who are hardly interested in civil liberties. So it's a bit difficult to see how much his strategy has worked. On the other hand, as I mentioned, the president has called for a debate. Wouldn't you like to be in this debate? I mean, I'm ready to go.
I think a debate would be great. But we need to have the information to have the debate. I mean, even today, the documents that were released, I'm glad they were released. They're helpful. But the what's called the primary order, which is the FISA court's order to the government, saying what the government, what the restrictions are and how the government uses Americans' telephone records, that order had a classified appendix which explained when the government actually goes to query the data, what that means and what the government can do when it queries the data. And that appendix was not released. And that is really some of the most important information that we need to know. So we can't have a debate on that yet. And there are plenty of other things. I mean, you know, to the extent what we've read about X key score is accurate, that's something we need to have a debate about, and the government hasn't said anything about it. So it is very hard to have a debate without when only one party to the debate has the information.
Just in closing, though, Elizabeth Goitein, there is a sort of been a steady erosion of our protections under the Fourth Amendment, arguably under the Fifth Amendment, because there's so much information out there, a lot of which people willingly give to Google and Facebook, to the extent to which, you know, so much information about you out there that you could be incriminating yourself without knowing it. But just in terms of the erosion of the Fourth, you know, we have drones now with infrared that can look into your home. So, you know, the idea of you being secure in your person and your home and your papers under the Fourth Amendment, I mean, I don't believe it makes any sense to revive the Fourth Amendment to bring it in line with the 21st century so much as it makes more sense to make it robust and return to its intention. I mean, do you think that those that argue that we need to update it in the electronic age are really at the really saying that we should water it down as opposed to restore its robust fundamental nature?
Well, I suppose depending on where you're coming from, you could mean different things by saying it needs to be updated to grapple with the information age. What I would say is that some of the doctrines that came about under the Fourth Amendment were premised on certain assumptions about the presence or absence of certain technologies at the time. And that's unfortunate because what happened is that the technologies changed, and so the assumptions no longer hold true, and so the doctrines no longer make sense. So, for example, there's something called the public space doctrine, which means you have no expectation of privacy in what you do in public. But that was when, you know, somebody observing you in public might see what you do as you walk down the street, and that was it. We didn't have surveillance drones. We didn't have GPS tracking. We didn't have cell phone location information that enabled the government to put together a comprehensive picture of all of your movements outside of your home, potentially from cradle to grave. And obviously, you should have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. So what we need, I would say, more than updating the Fourth Amendment, we need to make sure that we have a technology-neutral Fourth Amendment that will protect us regardless of changes in technology. And we don't have that right now.
Well, Elizabeth Goitein, I
actually have one more. Can I make one more point?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I made the point in my op-ed that right now we are still a relatively free country, certainly compared to a lot of other countries around the world. But I should say that in the early part of the Cold War, that was not the case. There were people whose careers were ruined and whose lives were ruined because they got on blacklists. There were people who sort of lived under a cloud because of their political and ideological beliefs. And what happened is that when some of the abuses that happened by the government came to light in the 1970s, there was a response. And the response was to put in place a series of laws and policies that established a kind of golden rule. And the golden rule was that intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies do not collect information on Americans unless they have a reason, unless there is some basis for suspicion of wrongdoing or some suspicion that the person is associated with a foreign power. And that golden rule served us very well for decades. And, you know, the 9/11 Commission found fault with a lot of government practices, but it never said we need to collect more information about Americans with less suspicion. And yet, since 9/11, that golden rule has just completely unraveled. And across just a range of laws and policies, the government is now able to collect information about Americans with little or sometimes no suspicion of wrongdoing. That should worry us. That should worry us very much because it just reopens the door to some of the abuses that we saw, in J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and abuses by the CIA and the NSA during the early part of the Cold War.
Well, Elizabeth Goitein, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at the Christian Science Monitor is The Danger of American Apathy on NSA Surveillance. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the president's grand bargain for the largely mythical middle class.
But they beg you away my name. I got one hell of a job to perform for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day, I salute the flag and say, thank you, Jesus, because I'm a secret agent, man.
Got a nightlife, lost his day job. Pushing paper, swinging pendulums. Anything to serve a function or to occupy some time. You gotta earn this living somehow. You're good as dead without a bank account. But it's funny how a life you fell down in that unemployment line with all that trash.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Madrick, a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics for Harper's. He edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and is the director of the Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case of Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Madrick.
Good to be here.
And the Dallas Fed just issued a report a couple of days ago, which was quite alarming. Not that we didn't know about the damage done to the economy from the 2008 financial crash. Their study is called How Bad Was It? The Cost and Consequences of the 2007-2009 Financial Crisis. They put a conservative estimate of the damage to the U.S. economy at $14 trillion, or roughly 1 year of U.S. GDP. So when in your last book you talk about the triumph of finance and the decline of America, nothing is more stark than those figures.
Well, you know, it's interesting that economists rarely talk about the cost of recessions or financial crises. In fact, there's an economic school of thought, unsurprisingly, coming out of Chicago and Minnesota and places like that, universities of, that recessions don't matter, that the losses really are not of consequence and are made up on the way back up. I think this crash was so severe that it is hard to be blithe about the losses due to recessions and financial crises. And it's interesting that the Dallas Fed is doing it because they are a pretty conservative lot. I've had my run-ins over cost of living, standard of living issues with them before. They tended to be afraid of inflation under every mattress and didn't want much stimulus, usually, in their past. So it's interesting that they have seen it, found it necessary to talk about the enormous hit this economy took due to the crash, the financial crash, and the losses of homes and the losses of borrowing power and so forth, and the recession itself, the soaring unemployment, the lack of investment, the fact that wages are not going up on average and therefore going down for lots of people, long-term unemployment. These are enormous costs that stay with us over time, and it's something economists are starting to pay attention to, but should be paying far more attention to. And it says something about the economics profession that they haven't done much of that before.
But what's happened in post-2008 crash has been that Wall Street got rewarded for almost destroying the global economy, and the public who paid for to make them whole has been punished. And even the Dallas Fed points out that the recovery from the financial crisis has been much, much slower than any other recovery since World War II. And that is obviously to do with the way that the Republicans have seized on this as a reason to cut the deficits caused by the bailout to rescue Wall Street and have prevented any real stimulus to rescue Main Street. So I find it extraordinary that the president has been able to – I guess he's too complicit in helping Wall Street.
I think he was complicit. You know, of course, the famous book by Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff called This Time is Different that traces a lot of banking crises. Always there was a very slow economic recovery after those crises. But they are very explicit in that book, and you will rarely hear – in journalistic accounts or even economists' accounts of the book, the following. They say nothing about the effects of economic policy that was adopted after those crises. For the most part, no economic policy of expansion was adopted over those crises. After those crises historically, Keynes is a rather new development, John Maynard Keynes, Keynesianism. And even both of them urged stimulus. But now, because of that, because Republicans have focused on the size of the deficit, almost entirely caused by the recession itself, reducing income and therefore tax revenues, and also the war spending, and in addition, the George Bush tax cuts from way back 10 years ago, that produced a very large deficit, and it became a lightning rod for Republicans to claim we've got to reduce the size of government. That led to destimulus, sequestration, and so forth. But we have to keep in mind what you mentioned at the end of your last comment. To what degree was Obama complicit in this? To a great degree is the answer. A few days before he was inaugurated in 2009, he called for a fiscal responsibility conference to focus on the deficit as the economy was falling apart. We can't focus on stopping a deficit when the economy is falling apart. In fact, we have to probably increase it a little bit at that time to get the economy going again. So Obama started it off, talked about and Larry Summers and all those people were there. Larry Summers is being talked about as the new Fed chairman. They were there, you know, they're his advisors. Where the heck were they? Then finally he comes up with that stimulus, which was too little. It wasn't too late, but it was too little. He could have gone back a second time. He hardly ever talked about the stimulus again. And even Alan Blinder, who's a moderate left-of-center Democrat, says in his new book, he was a Fed vice chairman for a while, and he's a professor, for instance, says in his new book that all that bashing of the word stimulus made it impossible, at least in Obama's mind, to talk about stimulus again. So Obama, to put it politely, screwed up big time. And his advisors, I would think, screwed up big time as well. We don't have adequate information about what they were talking about at that time. But I think they were worried about deficits. Larry Summers and Bob Rubin in Clinton's administration, even when they had surpluses, were spending their surpluses on paying down debt instead of much-needed public investment in infrastructure and education.
Which, of course, is what the president spoke about yesterday in his grand bargain. Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics at Harper's. He edits Challenge magazine and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books and is the director of Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His latest book is Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. So the president was on the Hill today talking to Democrats who gave him an earful about Larry Summers, clearly not a popular choice. And then yesterday in Chattanooga, Tennessee, he made his big pitch for a grand bargain, the way he would cut U.S. corporate tax rates and use billions of dollars in revenues generated by a business tax to overhaul, create jobs and overhaul infrastructure and invest in infrastructure in the United States. And most of his pitch was about rescuing the middle class. And so, in other words, it's taken all this long to forget about Wall Street, who have been rewarded, and focus on Main Street, who have been punished. But what I find amazing, Jeff Madrick, is that the idea of this vast American middle class in itself is something of a myth, because the recent report from the AP indicates that 4 out of 5 Americans have experienced essentially poverty, near poverty, homelessness, and have had to turn to government assistance at some point.
Or joblessness at some point.
Joblessness, yeah. So isn't it fascinating to think that 50% of Americans consider themselves middle class, and that's why, obviously, Obama is appealing to them, but nobody wants to deal with the reality that most of Americans aren't in the middle class?
Well, you raise a very good point, Ian. I think we need more data on this, but there's no question. Long ago, Bob Kuttner talked about the hollowing out of the middle class. So the middle class remains a useful mythology for Democrats who are, in fact, afraid to talk to the public about helping poor people or struggling people.
Well,
so this whole
people,
middle-out strategy, which in a way I agree with, because it's really talking about wages and raising wages to lead the economy back to prosperity. I agree with that, but the idea that it's about, you know, creating or reinforcing the middle class is kind of a political trick. Not even kind of, it's a political trick. We've got an awful lot to do. I think a lot of Obama's programs are correct. I think, sadly, he leaves out curing what I think is the biggest problem in America, child poverty. We have the largest child poverty rate in the world, which I know you've talked about often. But he's been trying to reverse the sequestration stuff, these automatic cuts, since early this year. And somewhere along the line, he did start talking about jobs, I think, sometime in early 2012 or 2011. But he flips back and forth on it, deficits, jobs, and so forth. The irony is the journalistic reports had it that the Obama administration was the first to bring up and propose sequestration when we had that government debt showdown back in 2011 that led to this horrible situation we're in. We're adopting full-fledged austerity economics. Not as bad as Europe, thank goodness, but we are really cutting off our nose to spite our faces by reducing government stimulus at a time when we should be increasing it, and slowing down an economy that's just possibly catching on and keeps being knocked down by these hard asses in Congress. I hope I can say that on your radio station.
Well, Jeff Madrick, what's extraordinary, though, is that when the Democrats celebrate bipartisanship, as they did recently on the immigration bill, what they don't want to mention is that they've got taken by the Republicans, that the reason that they were able to pass that immigration bill in the Senate was because all the money that was taken out of the Pentagon in sequestration, the Republicans put back into that bill in the form of so-called strengthening the border. So their backers, their financiers for the Republican hirelings in the Congress were taken care of. Now, when the president comes out and says he wants to take care of the middle class again, first of all, Boehner doesn't even return his calls when he gives him a heads up that he's going to make this speech. And then Boehner comes out and says, oh, you know, the president, I just read about it in the papers. I, you know, he didn't inform me. And in advance about this, and apparently they did. Boehner doesn't return Obama's calls. So there you have the dysfunction, but you also have the attitude, which is bipartisanship has become, when the Democrats get hosed by the Republicans, that's bipartisanship. But when the White House suggests something that should be done, it's dead on arrival.
Yeah, well, the bipartisanship has been a nasty a joke on Obama from the very beginning. That's why he made all those concessions on the stimulus bill in the first place, and he kept making concessions, and I just don't know what was in his head. He had no sense of the nature of these Republicans. He had some arrogant notion he could talk anybody into anything. I think that's from teaching too often. It's easy to talk to your students into something because they want an A from you.
But what can the Democrats do? I mean, everybody says they got to get tough, they got to man up. But what can they do?
They can get rid of the filibuster.
Right.
Which they're loath to do. You know, they keep saying the filibuster is, it'll come back to haunt us when we're the majority and they're the minority. Well, you know, it's mostly been used, as Tom Harkin, the senator, the fine senator, always says, it was originally really designed to stop desegregation, to stop integration and maintain segregation. It's mostly been used by the right wing, not the left wing. And it's become totally debilitating in terms of getting anything done in Congress. So I would certainly start there, get rid of the darn filibuster.
But what do you do about the House, though? What do you do?
Well, the House, you've got to win back. I just don't know what you do. If they have enough defeats, now in some cases they've been splitting off. They're splitting off on the NSA to some degree. I know you've just said something interesting about immigration, but they're splitting off to some degree on those kinds of issues. So if the Senate gets a little more juice, a little more power to pass legislation, I think the House is going to have to come along and compromise a little bit. And it could be that people are getting tired of these extreme right-wingers in their party, and they may start to isolate them, but you know, now it's partly wishful thinking on my part. If we continue, you know, their objective, as we know and as you've talked about often, is to keep Obama from getting elected. So they just don't want to see a good economy. And he's got to fight them on that. I think we've got a chance to have a decent economy, even with sequestration. So things are not all bleak. And parts of Obamacare are going to work. You have some benefits there in California I've been reading about in terms of insurance costs. They're going to try to stop that, but I don't think they'll be able to defund that. At least that's what people more knowledgeable politically than myself tell me. So it's not all bleak, I don't think. There are some breaks in the clouds, but it's still mostly clouds.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Madrick, who writes a column on economics for Harper's and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and is the author of Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. But how does the president frame this argument? I mean, obviously, it's a politically wise to continue to talk about the myth of the middle class, although, as you point out, Democrats should really talk about that they're in it to support working Americans, which in the post-Clinton Democratic Party, since they pivoted to Wall Street, is becoming something of a lie. But just as accepting that they want to propagate this myth of the vast middle class and they're scared of standing up for the rank and file who vote Democrat, how do you deal with the sort of delusions that, you know, 50% of the country think they're in the middle class when 80% of them are actually in the working class? And even within the Pew study that was done last year that came up with these figures, 6% of those earning over $100,000 consider themselves to be lower class, while another 6% of those earning less than $30,000 consider themselves to be in the upper class. So clearly there's no consensus on what on class. And frankly, my argument would be, Jeff Madrick, that what we really need in this country is affirmative action based on class, not on race.
Well, I do think jobs, subsidies for lower-income people make sense. But, you know, my one thing, I guess if I had to adopt phrases that might work and are true, I would be talking about decent jobs are a basic human right. I wouldn't be talking about middle versus who knows what. Decent jobs are a human right, and we have fewer and fewer decent jobs in America, and we need an America that creates decent jobs. It's about human dignity. It's about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's about it's not about social class and narrow economic ideas and government deficits. It's about what America should be. There should be a decent job for every person who wants them. To some degree, that might involve government creating jobs, police corps, education corps, infrastructure, construction corps, and so forth, a la the New Deal. Why the heck not?
Well, it's sort of what he talked about yesterday in Chattanooga, but of course, he made his pitch for the grand bargain at the Amazon warehouse in Chattanooga, and I'm not sure that warehouse jobs are the—I mean, maybe they are the future, but they certainly aren't exactly—
Well, they've knocked the heck out of—what do they call that, the Midland Empire in California or something, that are all warehouse jobs?
Right.
And all those cities are going bankrupt, but the— you know, his chief economist, Jason Furman, once wrote a paper in support of Walmart, so I'm not so surprised. Mm-hmm. But that's the pitch I would use. I wouldn't talk about middle class, and then you need the programs to do it. It's not just education. It's actually going out and creating decent jobs. It's giving job subsidies to companies to create jobs. It's getting that money back from overseas and taxing it properly and using it for retraining and proper education. My own view, which is not one that's talked about very much, is child poverty is a critical and tragic issue. You can have all the decent pre-K and K through 12 you want, but when you bring up one-fourth of your children in poverty, they are nutritionally, psychologically, emotionally deprived. They don't have any reason to be optimistic. They don't have a reason to dream. How are they going to latch onto even an improved K through 12 or pre-K through 12 education system? You hardly get economists talking in those terms. They have such narrow views. Improve education, they say, and with no sense of the fight people have for a decent life now.
Well, Jeff Madrick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Madrick, who's a journalist, economic policy consultant, and analyst who currently writes a column on economics for Harper's, edits Challenge magazine, and contributes regularly to the New York Review of Books. He's the director of the Rediscovering Government Project at the Roosevelt Institute and is a professor of humanities at Cooper Union. His books include Taking America, The End of Affluence, The Case for Big Government, and Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.